All right, Mark chapter 12. Verse 13, we've just come off the parable of the talents. Jesus cleanses the temple after the triumphal entry. They decide that that wasn't something that they were going to just sit by and let happen without some sort of investigation. So they question His authority with a question. Jesus doesn't answer the question. Instead, He gives them a question that they refuse to answer. And Jesus says, fine, then I'm not going to answer your question. And then He goes on and answers both questions in chapter 12, but in a parable, because their hearts are rebellious. And at the end of the parable, in which He indicts them for the way in which they've treated the servants of God, the doulos of God, the prophets of God, both the prophets of the Old Testament as well as John the Baptist himself, Jesus says, and guess what? You're also going to treat God's Son the same way. And as a result of your consistent, violent desire to keep the power that you think you possess, He says, God's going to take away the vineyard from you and give it to those that belong to Him. An indictment on them, which basically says, you're not the bearers of the kingdom anymore. It's going to be given to those that follow me. And there may be some implications of that when it comes to the church and its identity, but we won't get into that much because we want to get into paying taxes. So at the very end of the parable, the way in which they react is exactly the way they reacted in the parable. It says, after Jesus told them this, they realized the parable was about them, naturally. And they looked for a way to arrest Him and ultimately to kill Him. But because the crowds were there, they decided to chill out. Kind of. Because what we're going to see now is this tension that's been building since the triumphal entry will start to really build here over chapter 12. As a matter of fact, over the next 2 days, we're going to be... today's Wednesday, 3 days. We're going to be looking at both of the... There are three attacks against Jesus that will occur. Three in a row. One about paying taxes to Caesar. One about the resurrection and marriage, which we'll get to both of those today. One about the greatest commandment. And then Jesus responds with a counterattack whenever He starts asking about the identity of the Christ in comparison to David. Then we move into after your test next week. Yeah, I don't mean to bring that up right now, but after your test next week on Tuesday, we will then move on Wednesday and Thursday leading up to Thanksgiving, talking about what I think is the climax of the conflict when Jesus blatantly spends a whole chapter pronouncing judgment on the temple, something He's already alluded to in chapter 11. And we'll talk about that next week. So you've seen where we're headed. Because after chapter 13, guess what happens? It's chapter 14, where Jesus is arrested in Gethsemane, leads right into the cross. The tension is intentionally building in the Gospel of Mark to lead us to the point of the cross, which ultimately leads us to the resurrection. So Mark, chapter 12, verse 13. Later, they sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to Jesus to catch Him in His words. What's their motivation? Trip Him up for what purpose? Yes, to get their honor back. Because Jesus, consistently in His ministry, has had conflicts with them in which He has shamed them. He comes into the city of Jerusalem in the way in which He does, and again, that shames them. The masses are giving their verdict on a consistent basis. And the verdict that keeps coming back is that Jesus is the one they want to follow. Problem is, Jesus does stuff like going through the temple and cleansing it, or pronouncing judgment on the whole system in the temple, shaming them. And instead of repenting and submitting and gaining the honor of Jesus by following Him, they decide to fight. So what they do is they decide they're going to trip Him up in His words. We're going to launch a counterattack. But the way in which they do this is very strategic, both to try to protect themselves and to try to accomplish their goal ultimately. Matthew chapter 22, verse 16 tells us that the Pharisees actually send their disciples. Why would they do that? To try to trip up Jesus. Why would they do that?
Is that to try to say that Jesus isn't worthy of them?
Yeah, there is something in that whenever you say, I'm only going to send my servants to deal with you, because that's all you're really worth in my eyes. They're making an honor statement on Jesus. We're going to send my disciples. And guess what? If the disciples lose the battle, it's not as bad as the chief leaders themselves. So there's someone insulating themselves and launching an attack on Jesus by who they send to engage him. Is this making sense? But they also send the Herodians, which is a strange bedfellow when it comes to the Pharisees. Pharisees, while they're considered by the Sadducees primarily, theologically liberal because of their oral traditions, etc., politically they are considered very conservative. Very conservative. Herodians, not as much. Herodians, not as much. Herodians are the followers of Herod, who is the, in a sense, the vassal ruler of the Roman Empire. He is the agent of Rome. Therefore, bedfellows with Rome for the Herodians is not that far of a stretch when it comes to history. My goodness, Herod the Great, the reason why he got any of his power in the beginning of the first century BC was because he was a key political player in the accommodation of the region of Judea for the Romans. And as a result, they said, "We will honor you by making you king." He tries to pass it on to his sons, who make somewhat of a mess. Nevertheless, you have followers of people that are dedicated to Herod. So you have politically conservative Pharisees teaming together with politically liberal, in the eyes of the Jews, Herodians. Why? They have a common enemy. That's definitely true. Absolutely. In the honor game, Jesus has stolen something from both of them, and they want it back. Why else? Given the context, why else? Because it's about paying taxes. And in that context, you're going to have a spectrum. You're going to have one side of the people that do not want to pay taxes to evil Rome. Who do you think would probably be supporting that idea the most?
Pharisees.
Evil Rome. Who kept us in slavery. We're going to be talking about some of the early messianic movements leading up to this that really centered around taxes. Do not pay taxes to Caesar. The Pharisees, if Jesus then says the opposite, Pharisees will use their grassroots movement to launch an attack on Jesus. However, if who then on the other end of the spectrum, what do the Herodians want him to say? Herodians, though, if they are in league with the empire, they probably would say, paying taxes, why would you not want to pay taxes? It supports our benefactor. It supports the one that gives us the charis, that gives us the pox that we covet. Therefore, if Jesus says, don't pay taxes, Herodians are going to say, I have a problem with that. So what they do is they give this loaded question to their disciples. And then they team them up in a situation where no matter what Jesus says, one of them is going to use their power in order to attack him. You see what's happening? Therefore, they feel like that what they've done, in a sense, is trap Jesus to the point where he doesn't have an option, and it's even by their underlings. So when it comes to the honor game, you can have a how much more then are the chief leaders of the Pharisees, honorable than Jesus. Is this making sense? You see what they've positioned themselves to do? Very brilliant political tactic. Quite brilliant. So, later they sent some of the Pharisees and Herodians to Jesus to catch him in his words. They came to him and said, "Teacher." Oh, we've seen that before, haven't we? Several times, yes? What's the most recent? Can you remember? The rich guy would have been in chapter 10, 17 through 20. There's one right after that, and it's James and John coming asking for the chief priests. Whenever the word teacher is used, what can you assume about the person talking? They're speaking from some sort of outsider perspective. Now, the intention behind the person can vary. Sometimes it's out of ignorance. Sometimes it's out of lack of confidence. Whenever you had the man after the transfiguration where he says, "Teacher, your disciples couldn't cast out the demon from my son." You see? But in this scenario, teacher's being used by people that are outsiders with the intention of sedition, of subversion, of undercutting Jesus. Yes, Haley.
Apply to the other gospels when they use teacher?
I'm not going to extend that. Okay. And the reason why, it's possible, and I would investigate it, but every single gospel, How do I say this without undercutting something that's very important to our school? Every single gospel has a particular voice I think we need to respect. I mean, they use different words and even different concepts sometimes in different ways. Even the different order of the stories. On some level, I understand that Origen had a hexapla, which, you know, was kind of the first chronological life of Christ. But that's not Mark's intention. As a matter of fact, even the early church fathers told us that wasn't Mark's intention. He did not write this down in order to give us an orderly account. So says the anti-Marcionite prologue. That's not even his point. Therefore, I'm a big advocate of let's understand the individual voices of each of the Gospels. And when they dialogue, that's fine. I'm not saying don't ever let them dialogue. But what I am saying is whenever they are dialoguing, make sure that they actually have their own voice and it's not all just one big mega voice. Does that make sense? That's for everybody. So it's a mild critique. I'm not in any way saying that, you know, our four semesters of life for Christ are illegitimate. I'm not saying that. I think there is a place for that. But I do get a little nervous because sometimes you can go through the whole life of Christ and walk out and I say, so what's really Mark's heartbeat? Oh, I have no idea. What? You don't know what Mark's voice is trying to add to the conversation? There's four for a reason. And there's danger whenever you just, but then none of them have a voice at all. Okay. They came to him and said, Teacher, we know you are a man of integrity. Oh, do you? You aren't swayed by men. No, that now they do know that. He's pretty much consistently showed them that the whole honor game they play, he's not as interested in, although he beats them in it anyway. You're not swayed by men because you pay no attention to who they are. Yeah, that's true too. Maybe they've heard stories of the feeding of the 4,000, which was done in what territory? Gentile territory. But you teach the way of God in accordance with the truth. Okay. So, is it right to pay taxes to Caesar or not? Oh, that's shady. Should we pay or shouldn't we? That would have been a question that was very near and dear to the hearts of the Jews, especially at the time of Passover, when they're looking to cast off the oppressive yoke of the empire. And one of the ways in which the oppressive yoke of the empire was symbolized on them, and one of the ways they symbolized their rebellion of it, was directly connected to taxes. As a matter of fact, in AD 6, so you're talking 20, 25 years earlier, AD 6, you have Roman taxation that begins to be asserted against the Jewish people, which actually causes a Jewish revolt led by a messianic figure known as Judas of Galilee. As a matter of fact, Josephus in Antiquities 18.4 says that Judas of Galilee reacts to the taxes in this way. He says, "Yet there was one named Judas, who became zealous to draw them to a revolt, who both said that this taxation was no better than an introduction to slavery." Did you hear that? Taxation was no better than an introduction to slavery, and he exhorted the nation to assert their liberty. Taxes, in some sense, can be connected to the oppressive yoke of another empire, whether that is true or not true. Does not our country in and of itself have a bit of that history? Taxation without representation, remember this? Taxes throughout history is both used by empires and interpreted by revolutionaries as an oppressive act. And in fact, it was an oppressive act by the Romans, especially at certain times whenever they allowed the taxes to rise as high as 60%. That's incredible. But the reason why Rome would do that is because they're trying to send a message in every facet of their life, down to their money that they make, that we own you. We own you. And if you don't like it, well, you better pay your taxes otherwise. Matter of fact, in AD 66, in AD 39, so 6 years after this account, and about 30 years after this account, the Jews rebel against the Romans. because of religious oppression and the way in which both of the revolts are started. The AD 66, which leads to destruction of the temple, and in AD 39, whenever Caligula said, I'm going to put my statue up in the temple of Jerusalem, the reaction of the Jews, both of them, was to stop paying taxes. They're sending an equally symbolic message. We will not bow down to your slavery. This question then has quite a history. It's embedded in the minds of the Jews that taxes equals slavery to the empire. And so they come to Jesus and they say, should we pay taxes? Should we be aligned with Rome monetarily? Pretty important question. Politically, a very explosive question. And frankly, Jesus' answer either way seems to paint him into a corner in which he will be punished by someone. For if he says, pay the taxes, all the people that support the Pharisees, the grassroots movements, will ostracize him, if not kill him. If he says, don't pay them, you better believe the Herodians are going to scurry away to their superiors and say, guess what Jesus said? So, Jesus, verse 15, should we pay taxes or not? But Jesus knew their hypocrisy. He knew what was happening here. They didn't. They were using Rome as a pawn, which is so much, so ironic in this. Why are you trying to trap me? He says. Bring me a denarius and let me look at it. Let's look at a denarius and see what Jesus was asking for and see what they gave him. This is a denarius. This is what they would have held. This is what Jesus would have looked at and held up as a discussion point. Let me talk about what's on the front. On the front, that is the face of Tiberius, the emperor that is reigning right now. The emperor that is reigning at this point. Is my little pointer work? Yay. The emperor that's reigning right now. And now let's talk about what's along the sides here, around it. It says T.I., which is Tiberius, Caesar, divine, would have been the first three words, which are for right here. There's the T.I., Caesar, Divi, which is divine. This is Latin abbreviation, which makes it all the more difficult. So we're not only going from English to Latin, but then we have to see why they're abbreviating. T.I., Caesar, though, is all spelled out. You can see that with the little C-A-E-S-A-R. See that, everybody? And then Divi, divine. So you have Tiberius, the divine Caesar. And then over here, A-U-G. There we go. Augustus. You see A-U-G, which actually would be emperor. The A-V, it looks like a V. A-V and then G. Emperor. The emperor, son of, the I-F, which follows it, is son of Augustus. So let's put that all together. Tiberius, the divine Caesar, the emperor, son of Augustus. That's what it says on the front. Everybody following this? So what's it proclaim Tiberius to be on the front? God. Divine. Son of God. So we should be, I guess, theologically on some level accurate. On the back, it just paints the picture even better. On the back is a picture of a woman named Livia. Livia was Augustus's third wife, which was also the mother of Tiberius. That's his mom. He's a mama's boy, in more ways than one, actually, if you know the wife of Tiberius. She's pictured as reigning on a throne and holding an olive branch, which olive branch, even for the Romans, would have been connected to peace and things of that nature, as well as a spear. Now, that's important because these two emblems, both the olive branch as well as the spear, are the key symbols of the god Pax, or peace. That peace is attained through the blade. His mom, then, is being portrayed as a goddess that brings peace. So not only is he the son of a god, Augustus, he's also the son of the goddess of peace. And what it says on the back, if you can read it, it says Pontiff Maxim, which means what? High priest. So what does it claim Tiberius to be on the front? And what does it claim for him to be on the back? High priest. This may be borderline blasphemous. You following this? It's making sense. But there are several things that are wrong in this moment. Jews, when it came to bringing graven images into the city of Jerusalem at all, more or less the temple, but into the city at all, they were passionately opposed to it. Passionately opposed to it. As a matter of fact, in Josephus, Jewish Wars 2.9.2-4, it describes Pontius Pilate and his soldiers bringing graven images into the city. And the Jewish people erupted. They freaked out. He just brought them into the city. And they were going crazy. Matter of fact, for 5 days, there were very heated discussions with Pilate and his people. And finally, Pilate tricks the Jewish leaders into a situation where all the Jewish leaders are gathered. And all of a sudden, Pilate unveils that his whole army had already surrounded them. And he said, "You not only allow us to have the graven images in your city, but we're going to take them to your temple. And if you don't like it, we will kill you right now." And incredibly, all the Jewish leaders all bent down on their knees, stretched out their necks, and they say, "Do what you must." And Pilate said, "Well, I can't wipe out all of them." And so Pilate retreated and actually took all the graven images out of the city. It was in a sense where the nonviolent acts, which is so ironic after the parable of the vineyard, of the Jewish people is what actually accomplished what they wanted. It actually put Rome in its place. Nevertheless, you can see the passion, though, with which graven images is something they don't even want in their city. More or less blasphemous titles that are surrounding graven images. But where are we in this scene? This is where the irony gets all a bit strange. Because what does it say in the very next verse? They brought the coin to Jesus. Now Luke chapter 20 verse 1 tells us, it says, this is what Luke chapter 20 verse 1 says, that this event occurs one day as Jesus was teaching the people in the temple courts. Where are we? In the temple? Piece this together then. What's so strange about this event? Yeah, Jesus says, "Oh, I'm sorry, I don't have one of the denarius that you would need in order to pay the emperor. Do you have one?" "Oh, we've got one." They're standing in the temple, bringing out graven images with blasphemous titles for the emperor around it. And Jesus says, "Oh, you have one." I mean, honestly, the laws are only important to them when it's convenient for them. But man, if they can further themselves, their political agenda, by bending or breaking some of the laws, like bringing a graven image into the temple itself with blasphemous titles in order to punish Jesus or shame him, hey, we'll do whatever we need. A bit ironic, I think. And this is how Jesus responds. But they brought the coin, and he asked them, "Whose portrait is this?" What's their answer? "Caesar." "And whose inscription?" "Caesar's," they replied. Then Jesus said to them, "Give to Caesar what's Caesar's and give to God what's God's." That's pretty huge. Because what Jesus is saying is this. If you truly have the correct lens of the kingdom on, the question then would be, why would you want to keep what Caesar asks for his taxes? Why would you want to keep this? Are you fighting for this money? This is what you're fighting for? Why do you want this? Whose image is on it? Are you comfortable with his image? I mean, whose description is on this? Are you comfortable with that description? So why do you want me to tell you to keep the money? Do you want this money? My goodness, paying the taxes is actually getting rid of something that you didn't want to begin with. Isn't it? Paying taxes then, actually, Jesus turns around and says, this is actually a subversive act. You give back to the one that worships what he has given you. Give the stinking money back to the emperor. Because in our kingdom, not only is this blasphemous, but this has no value. I don't understand why you're telling me to keep, why you want me to tell you to keep it. Keep it away from Caesar. Who here wants this inside of the temple of God? Raise your hands. Jesus looks at him and asks, who are you worshiping? The image? The title? The high priest and the divine Son of God? Is that why you're wanting to keep this? He says, your question is betraying the fact that you can't see, that you're not hearing, that ultimately, us paying taxes is saying, we don't even rely on you. We don't need your money. Because we have a God that's got way bigger pocketbook than you'll ever dream of. Why do I need your stinking money? It's one of the things where people, even in today, they'll ask the question, should we not pay taxes because it's going to pay for wars we don't believe in? Like I might say, do you think that all the Christians believed in the wars that Rome was fighting? Ultimately, when you pay taxes, what you're saying is, what you value and what you think gives control and power in our kingdom doesn't at all. Therefore, you take what means most to you, and we'll keep what means most to us. And it's not this. Frankly, me giving taxes is me saying, even though this is going to something that I do think is evil, ultimately, I trust God will control it anyway. You see what Jesus is saying? He's saying, I know what Rome's going to do with this money. He's like, but ultimately, they're not in control anyway. So I'll let their system keep going, but just give it a couple hundred years and everything comes crashing down on Rome. Does it not? You see how this is an issue, but it's not an issue. Jesus is saying, where is your faith? Where is your faith? Oh, I'm going to protest and not pay your taxes. Really? Why? Why do you want to keep this? Man, give it to them. Let their kingdom continue to think that their kingdom's the one that's in control. But you know the truth. You know the truth. You don't even need their money in order for us to take over the world. Oh, good answer. You see how that's a good answer? That's nice. Basically what he's saying is this. If you're a part of my kingdom, you'd understand this question in and of itself is folly. It's absolutely ridiculous. But give to God's what's God's. What's God's? What is God's? Yeah, whatever bears His image or has His name written on it. See? You see the difference? You see what he's saying? Do I need to read Genesis chapter 1, verse 27? Which says, you know, that God created male and female, both of them. In His image, He created them. Give to God's what's God's. Ultimately, what God wants is not a blasphemous coin. God wants is you. Martin.
Do you see a connection between that and the fig tree parable and bearing fruit and what giving to God what is God's? And like the landowner, how he's wanting to... He's supposed to come and get the fruit from the vine. And in the parable the prior to, do you see a connection between what is God is God's? Do you see a connection between the fruit that is supposed to be given in the parable of chapter 12 as well as in the fig tree?
Absolutely. What is God coming to collect? How do we define fruit? How do we define what is rightfully owed to the landowner? Absolutely. And they would say, this! And Jesus says, no. If you think this is the fruit he's after, yeah, you're totally missing the boat. Totally missing it. You don't even understand what kingdom we're in. But if you look at it through the eyes of Rome, it makes perfect sense. That's the problem. We're not Rome. That's the problem. See what's happening? So actually what Jesus does is he exposes them again and says, man, you're still fighting for the other side. How else would you have a graven image and why are you fighting for it? Jesus says, honestly, you guys are more peculiar than anything. I don't really know what to do with you. Because if you really trusted God, oh, you wouldn't want this at all. You'd be longing to give it away to Rome. To get the stinking thing away from you. But instead, you even have one in the temple. Oh, this is awkward. Next accusation. Pharisees and Herodians fail, Sadducees say, because you weren't a part of our group. If you were a true Sadducee, you would have succeeded. So, verse 18. Then the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection. Notice that detail. It's not on accident. That detail actually is very important. People will take this next text out of context on a consistent basis. I actually get annoyed with the way I feel like interpreters just totally check out when they come to this next passage. What is this next passage normally used to teach us? We're not married in heaven. There's no sex in heaven. So whatever you do down here, you might as well live it up, because once you get up there, it's all eradicated. As a matter of fact, I've actually heard somebody say, oh yeah, what the Bible teaches is that once we get to heaven, I'll have just as much access to your wife as you do. I said, I don't even know how to process that, my friend. More or less, refrain myself from hitting you. I don't really know what I'm supposed to say to that. But that is how we use this text, isn't it? Isn't it? Have you heard a different interpretation of it, really? On a general... Normally that is the reason why this text is brought up. Here is the issue. They are asking a question they don't even believe in. You got to remember that. Right at the very beginning, he says the Sadducees ask a question. But don't forget, they don't believe in the resurrection. Therefore, Jesus' main point in teaching here is about the resurrection more than it is about marriage and sex in heaven. So if that's where you reduce this text down to, you're missing the point. And I think Jesus actually doesn't really comment on that at all. And if he does, I think he would even say the opposite based on this text. And we'll get to that now. Then the Sadducees, who say there is no resurrection, they don't believe in a resurrection. Why don't they believe in a resurrection? It's not in the Torah. Because they don't believe it can be found in the first five books of the Old Testament. Resurrection talk a lot of times, if we even approaches the concept of resurrection, it's in the Psalms or Daniel 12. And neither one of those are in the first five books, not in Moses, which is the text that Jesus will restrict himself to when he responds to them. They believe in no resurrection. They came to him with a question, of course. And naturally, verse 19, teacher, they said, Moses wrote for us, notice where they're appealing to, that if a man's brother dies and leaves a wife but no children, the man must marry the widow and have children for his brother. Okay, Moses did write that. That's in Deuteronomy chapter 25, 5 through 6. Maybe a good test question. I'll write that down. Deuteronomy chapter 25, 5 through 6. It says this. If brothers are living together and one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside the family. Notice the issue. If there are brothers, one of them dies and does not have a son, what's at issue here? Honor and the name being passed out. Literally, if you don't have a son and you die, your name is blotted out of the annals of history. That's a major shameful thing. So if brothers are living together, one of them dies without a son, his widow must not marry outside the family, otherwise that would be shameful on her first husband because he's blotted out of existence. Her husband's brother shall take her and marry her and fulfill the duty of a brother-in-law to her. The first son she bears shall carry on the name of the dead brother so that his name will not be blotted out from Israel. What is the issue here? In Deuteronomy 25, 5 through 6, what is the issue that he's addressing? Honor and the perpetuation of the name. Yes? It has nothing to do with sex, has nothing to do really with marriage. It has to do with honor, legacy, and provision. That's what it's focused on. Honor, legacy, and provision. You see what's happening here? Okay, we're building the case for what really is occurring. Fight out what you think of marriage and listen to what they're talking about in the context of marriage. So if the brother dies, in order for him not to be blotted out of existence, in order for his honor, and provision of his family to be taken on, provision of the honor that belongs to his family to continue, Levirate marriage, which is what this is called, would be implemented. Okay? Let's keep reading. Now there were seven brothers. The first one married and died without leaving any children. The second one married the widow, but he also died leaving no children. It was the same with the third. In fact, none of the seven left any children. Last of all, the woman died too. At the resurrection, hear their question. Whose wife will she be, since the seven were married to her? What are they trying to disprove? They're trying to make fun of the resurrection, aren't they? Isn't that their goal? Boy, the resurrection just sounds absolutely ridiculously convoluted. I mean, really. At the resurrection, who's this woman going to be married to? In eternal life. This woman had seven husbands. She just couldn't bear any children. Now, there's a couple of things happening here. We have to keep this with the lenses of honor and shame securely fastened. Number one, in this context, the woman is barren. She is barren. In an honor-shame context, it literally says that a wife would be considered a stranger until she bared a son for the husband. As a matter of fact, if the woman is perpetually barren, like this woman, she was actually likened to a man. And as a result, she was seen as a threat to the honor of the entire community. She is a liability. Number two, she's a widow seven times over. Which means there's some kind of curse on this woman. Because every person she marries dies seven times over. This actually is referring to an intertestamental period book. The Book of Tobit that you find in the Apocrypha. Which was written around the 2nd century BC. It's one of the 14 books that the Catholic Bible has in it, or the NRSV. The Book of Tobit, that's actually what you find in the Book of Tobit. A woman by the name of Sarah, with an H, so it's my wife's exempt. A woman by the name of Sarah lost seven husbands because the demon Asmodeus, every night, on the night in which they would consummate the marriage, at that night the demon Asmodeus would kill the man that she had just been legally married to before they could consummate. Every single time. Until a guy by the name of Tobias, not Arrested Development, Tobias, who's the son of Tobit, is on his way to Medea, and the angel Raphael comes, and he disguises himself as a stranger, and basically through the big large fish and the burning of the entrails, he gives them the key to marry Sarah, which was his cousin, thereby preserving the Levirate marriage issue, keeping honor going on in their family. He was able to marry her and consummate the marriage by keeping the demon Asmodeus away by burning the entrails of this fish. Now, regardless of whether or not you believe that is legitimate, or it doesn't matter to me. The point is, that's what they're referring to. A common Jewish story that they are now using in order to make folly of the resurrection. In that story, though, the woman is barren and cursed. So, the question really is this. Who's going to have to be stuck bearing the burden of this woman in the afterlife? That's the question. You see how it's different than our question? Will I get to love and be with my spouse throughout all of eternity? Is not the question they're asking. The question they're asking is, who's stuck with this consistent liability that's consistently cursed and has to bear the burden of her lack of honor and provide for her, even though she's likened to a man? A bit different. Instead, this piece of property is somewhat of a burden, and who's going to have to bear it both honor-wise and resource-wise? Because none of the seven men are really going to want to be with her. You see how this is a little different? You got to look at it through their lens. They're not marrying for the love that we find in Shakespeare plays. They're marrying to perpetuate honor. And they're saying, and yet she, because of her barrenness and cursedness, has shamed seven men who stuck with her in the afterlife. Jesus replied, Are you not in error because you do not know the scriptures or the power of God? Whoops. Those are what we call fighting words. You can write that down. Fighting words. He looks at me and says, oh, you Sadducees, teachers of the law, the ones that are head over the temple. Are you really so dumb? Do you not understand the scriptures or the power of God? Power of God. What do you think he's talking about? Resurrection. Right? When the dead rise. Notice the way he phrases that. He said, the problem is your first premise. Because the dead will rise. But when they rise, he says, they will neither marry nor be given in marriage. They will be like the angels in heaven. See? What is the issue Jesus is referring to? How are they defining marriage in this context? The burden of this piece of property that they will have to provide for, unfortunately, throughout all of eternity, with the lack of honor that she offers and with the curse that she bears. And Jesus looks at him and he says, don't you understand that in the kingdom of God, even in the afterlife, our honor and our provision is not dependent upon who we're married to. It's dependent upon God Himself, just like the angels. The angels aren't having to fight for their own honor and prestige like you. They trust God. Whose burden is she? Whose burden? Well, she's the burden of everybody. Just like she's God's burden. Just like everybody else. And he gladly takes it. Why? She bears his image. That's why. You see how this makes sense? He's saying one of the key problems for the question that you're asking is not just the resurrection, but it's the fact you don't even see this woman as somebody bearing the image of God. It reminds me of the divorce issue in chapter 10. He's saying you're looking at her as a liability, and God looks at her as something to be treasured. Therefore, it's not whose unfortunate responsibility it is, because honestly, everyone is God's responsibility, even the angels. Now about the rising of the dead. Notice he answered their question. Not by giving us an answer to who will be able to have sex with whom in heaven, or who will be bound to whom in heaven, but by saying what you are fighting for in this moment, the honor and the provision, both of resources that are limited, of honor and actual resources, has always been God's burden. It's not this burden, it's His burden. And He's gladly to take it both in this life and in the next, but you won't give Him in either one. You mistreat the woman who actually is compared to the greatest in the kingdom of heaven because she's an awful lot like children. Verse 26. Now about the dead rising. Have you not read in the book of Moses? Notice where he goes. Where does he go? To the source of authority that they only look to. In the account of the bush, the burning bush, how God said to him, I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. Key point, present tense. I am the God of Abraham, the God of Isaac, and the God of Jacob. What's the problem at the time of the burning bush with Moses? They're all dead. And Jesus says, He's not the God of the dead, but of the living. You are badly mistaken. The badly mistaken, therefore, refers to two accounts. Both the way in which women are viewed, both in this life and the next, because the least in the kingdom of heaven are actually the greatest. They are not someone's burden, they are someone to be treasured. Therefore, I don't believe Jesus is making a commentary at all about whether or not your spousal connection in this life carries over to the next. And if I had to make a guess at what he would say, is why would I eradicate something that I established in the garden? I'm not understanding this. I'm not understanding this. Do you think I'm looking at this through the eyes of Plato? And I see the sex and the things in which that married couples engage in as something bad that needs to be eradicated once we reach to the higher reality? Is that really the way you think that I have created this place? Really? He says, no, you don't even understand. So ultimately, though, the issue is, whose problem is this woman? And Jesus says, she's not a problem. She's something to be treasured. She's not cursed. She's something to be... She's God's responsibility. She always has been and she always will be. And he says, man, you're badly mistaken. You don't get this, and you don't get the resurrection. You are so messed up. You're so messed up. Because you don't even believe in the power of God to both take care of you or her or the afterlife. Their mistake is they don't know who God is. You see the issue? They ask a question they don't believe in. Jesus gives an answer they weren't expecting, because ultimately what he says is, your question and the way you're talking about this woman betrays you don't know who God is and what he values. Because you're thinking a lot like this. You don't have to agree with me. You might have to put that down to get an A on the test, but love you guys. We'll see you in the morning when we talk about the greatest commandment.